People divided, but friends united. Today, Wednesday, July 30th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Gal and Rawan have been close friends for more than a decade. Rawan is Palestinian.
The only thing that would make me feel safe is knowing that I have on the other side people like Gal I could have a conversation with.
Gal, as you may have guessed, is Israeli.
I can tell you that I love Rawan dearly, and most of our conversations don't even touch the conflict. I don't think that political issues will break our friendship.
We'll hear the story of that friendship. And later, why a Turkish official wants women to stop laughing.
It was something so basic that he pointed to indicate immorality, laughing in public as a woman.
Well, women in Turkey are not taking that seriously. It's all coming up, so stick around.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Marco Werman. You're tuned to The World. There is a small window of hope and optimism in the Mideast, and in a moment you will hear the voices of two women whose friendship is stronger than what divides them. But first, a quick update on what's happening in Gaza today. Several times in the past few weeks, we've had to report that bombs had fallen on schools run by the United Nations in Gaza. I'm talking schools where Gaza residents had sought refuge from the raging fight between Israel and Hamas. It's happened again. At least 15 Palestinian civilians were reported killed when suspected Israeli tank fire hit the school they were in. UN officials are expressing outrage, among them Chris Gunness, a spokesman for the main UN relief agency in Gaza. He noted that among those killed were children who had been sleeping with their parents on a classroom floor.
Children killed in their sleep. This is surely an affront to all of us, a source of universal shame. Today, the world stands disgraced.
The UN says it's briefed Israel repeatedly on the location of all its schools in Gaza. And for its part, the Israeli military says it doesn't target UN schools, but rather the Palestinian militants who often operate in the vicinity. Israel Defense Forces spokesman Peter Lerner says in this latest case, there was an exchange of fire with militants who had fired mortars from a location near the school.
We are currently looking into the tragic result. This is, you know, clearly we've seen the footage and it is heartbreaking. But we did not target UN facilities. We don't do that.
With the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as intractable as ever, we want to hear now from two young women, friends, both from Jerusalem, but who live on opposite sides of the divide. Rawan is Palestinian and Muslim. Gal is Israeli and Jewish. They first met more than a decade ago in the United States through a U.S.-based organization called Building Bridges. It brings together Israeli and Palestinian teens. Gal and Rawan became friends while in the U.S., and they're still friends today. Rawan was in Jerusalem until very recently. She's currently in Turkey. Gal is still in Jerusalem. And Gal says having a real friend on the opposite side of the conflict changes everything.
For example, if I want to know what things look like on the eastern side of Jerusalem, and I live in West Jerusalem, I have someone to ask. And so many people don't have the ability to ask questions, and the only way or the only method they are able to get information is from the media.
Rawan, this is the third war, and Gal, you too, that you've both lived through in 6.5 years. I mean, in terms of fear and your ability to even think about the future, a future without this violence, does this round of shooting and rockets feel scarier than anything before?
I don't think I've ever felt unsafe in my country as much as I feel today. I think partly because the manifestation of hatred and violence has gone beyond any imagination. I mean, I don't want to think about the numbers, but the numbers are there. It's not a comparison of who's getting more pain. The matter of fact is the only thing that would make me feel safe is knowing that I have on the other side people like Gal I could have a conversation with. And also knowing that with people like Gal on the other side, there is possibility of not only seeing the conflict from someone else's perspective, but also seeing that there are certain things that are wrong.
Like what?
Do I believe occupation, one example, violence, in my opinion, and that's a very personal opinion, obviously, is, in my opinion, very, very wrong. And many people resort to it, and I understand that. I don't condone it, and I don't support it. I seek justice. And to me, what's happening in Israel and Palestine now is not just.
Gal, I'm curious to know, in the pursuit of that justice, what do you think are the questions that do need to be asked?
I think, at least in the Israeli side, we are not sure about the answers. Our society is really divided. And in a way, that's something that makes the conversation really difficult. If you ask religious Jews or right-wing Jews what is just in Israel, they will tell you it's the land we got from God. And what is just is that we'll be controlling all of it. And if you ask Israelis from the more left-wing side of Israel, they will tell you that a just solution is more democratic, is leaning more toward civil rights, maybe dividing even Jerusalem. For me, I think, as a person who sees the other, we need to ask ourselves what the other gets from the policy that we're creating.
Again, I mean, these are points of view that are really refreshing to hear. And it occurs to me that, do you feel like these concepts, these thoughts are actually being put out there right now? Are they being marginalized at all? Are they being silenced in any way?
I think in a time of war, there is a phrase in Hebrew, you say, Sheket Yorim, quiet, there is a shooting. In times of war, I think I understand that it's hard to voice these type of voices. And in Israel, they are definitely being silenced. There is a strong support to the operation that is going on. I think there is a very strong fear right now of what is being going on in Gaza and the tunnels. And when people are scared, they are becoming angry. And it's hard for them to see the other side. And it's hard for them to see the 1,200 Palestinian dead on the other side.
Rawan, what about you? Are you worried that these points of view about justice and dialogue, are they being suppressed?
I do think that in times of violence, it is hard to listen to a different voice. It's hard to see, or it's easy to make invisible any voice that is not in support of let's defend ourselves, and if that cost is killing everyone else, let's do it. But it's unfortunately a common feeling. It's like survival mode at this point, and that is very, very frustrating, and it's also very, very sad. I know that having conversations with my own mother, and Gal and I had an opportunity to share these conversations together, my mom's only thing was like, she's like, I lived through multiple wars, and I just would like to die maybe one day with living in a time with no war. I think leaders, and I think individuals, and I think us as people who are really caring and loving for this world and loving for humanity and loving for life. We have a love for life. I think I would say I would like to listen to my mother, and I would like to be one of those people that might be able to one day give her a few years of no war.
I got to say, that is a very poignant wish. Rawan and Gal, what about you two? Do you think your friendship is unshakable?
I can tell you that I love Rawan dearly, and most of our conversations don't even touch the conflict. She knows my family and my partner for life, and I know her family, and we go really long back. I don't think that political issues will break our friendship.
Rawan, what about you? Is your friendship with Gal there forever?
I mean, I think that's the simplest question to ask.
Okay.
From all the questions you asked, this was the easiest one. I mean, we made friends, and I think we made friends for a very, very long time. And I think a big part of it is because there's a huge space for honesty and for us both to be ourselves and for us both to be able to be like, we are angry about this, and I am angry about this, and this is very frustrating for me. And feeling very safe in that place that we could have these conversations and be absolutely open and be absolutely people with each other.
Listen
the political
her.
Lines are the
How
political
can I
lines.
Not be a friend of her? She's great. She's wonderful.
Well, Rawan and Gal, thank you both for your honesty today and for this conversation with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for letting us voice another voice in Israel and Palestine.
Friends across the divide, Gal is Israeli, Rawan Palestinian. You can hear more from them in a documentary called My So-Called Enemy. Check out the preview at facebook.com/PRI the world. I know the news is often no laughing matter, but what if a government official told you not to laugh? That's what Turkey's deputy prime minister did. He specifically told Turkish women not to laugh in public. I'm not kidding. And you know how many women and many men in Turkey reacted? Yeah, that's right. Makes me want to laugh with them. There you go. Dalia Mortada is our reporter in Turkey, and she explained to me where all this is coming from.
It was part of an hour and a half long speech by the deputy prime minister, Bülent Arınç, as you mentioned, but basically addressing the lack of morality in society. And that line in particular sparked so much outrage because it was something so basic that he pointed to indicate immorality, laughing in public as a woman. He basically said, invited unwanted attention, invited unchaste behavior. And in this speech, I mean, he covered everything from overconsumption to using your cell phones too much as opposed to meeting in person, to men being unfaithful to their wives and being womanizers. It wasn't just this one line, but people were just sort of really outraged by it because it's just such a small thing to point out when there are so many other issues to look at.
So how many people are outraged in Turkey?
Usually the people that are outraged by this sort of thing and that would be bothered by this sort of thing are the people that aren't happy with the socially conservative, religiously conservative, and politically conservative AKP, who are the people that are in power in Turkey, the government. And so it's a sizable amount of the population. About 50% of the population doesn't like the current government. And when you start pointing at things as basic as laughing, it really is going to spark sort of at least a social media backlash, if nothing else.
Right. And that social media backlash has happened. It's not the first time a sarcastic humor campaign has been launched on social media in Turkey, right?
Not at all, actually. This sort of campaign of these women laughing, taking selfies of them laughing, which looks kind of funny because, you know, it's just them obviously mocking what they heard. But a few months ago, there was a media campaign of women taking photos of men's legs sort of sprawled out on public transportation, totally not minding, you know, the lines of the seat. And sprawled across the photos are, mind your legs, is what they said. And sort of, you know, this sort of sense of sarcastic humor, but basically like, watch your space, you know. Yeah. I'm here too.
Now, Twitter is one of these social media platforms that's been really huge in Turkey, really popular. It's also been banned by the Turkish government several times. But I guess with this situation, it doesn't seem to inhibit people from using it, even with the risk that it might temporarily disappear.
Right. I think the government saw that the Twitter ban, at least the most recent one, didn't work. People were still on it. It was very easy to bypass. And the people that support them, you know, if they're told not to use the social media, they'll probably follow what their leaders say. It's definitely a way that Turks use to sort of get out information and have their voices heard. And you're right. It's very popular in Turkey. Apparently, Turkey has the highest Twitter penetration rate in the world. 30%, over 30% of internet users actually use Twitter.
Wow.
Which is higher than even in the United States.
So how have Deputy Prime Minister Arınç and the government responded to this really vigorous online protest? Men and women basically saying, your statement in that speech is ridiculous.
Right. So Arınç actually came out today and gave another speech, basically pointing to the fact that he said that, you know, this is being taken out of context. I didn't intend to be sexist because it's an issue of a lot of women being upset and a lot of people being upset on the behalf of women for being pointed at, their laughter being sort of offensive to him. But he also told, you know, he also said something along the lines of, to those who are drawing international media attention to this, to what I said, why don't you ask that international media why they're not covering Israel and Gaza properly? Mm. So he tried to sort of deflect attention from this whole situation inside Turkey. And the government itself isn't saying much.
Yeah. Do you think it's just going to kind of peter out and women will continue to laugh?
I do believe that women will continue to laugh. Turkish society and culture definitely lends itself to that.
Dalia Mortada in Istanbul, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Marco.
This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TiVo. No need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or interfaces to access cable TV and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. Learn more at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Ebola, it's highly contagious, incurable, and often lethal. And how great is the concern over the Ebola outbreak in West Africa right now? In Liberia, they closed all schools today to try and prevent the disease from spreading. And in Sierra Leone, they're mourning the death of one of the leaders in the fight against Ebola. Dr. Sheikh Umar Khan died from the disease yesterday. Abubakar Tarawali is a senior official with the Sierra Leone Red Cross. He says Khan's death is a severe blow to the campaign against Ebola in his country.
He is and he has been the only specialist Sierra Leonean in country for treating of hemorrhagic fevers, including Ebola. So if he dies like he has died now, it means that there is that very big vacuum that needs to be filled. Although we now have the presence of some of our friends from the international community, some foreign medical officers with us in the field that are helping out with the treatment of infected people, I think the death of Dr. Khan clearly leaves a vacuum for us in Sierra Leone. Even though with him alive, it was still not enough to have only one medical doctor to be a specialist in treating of hemorrhagic fever for a country with about 6 million people.
Mr. Tarawali, are you at all frightened for your own safety?
I am very much concerned and worried about my safety and the safety of every Sierra Leonean, because do not forget that this Ebola disease is very unfamiliar to Sierra Leone, and also the level of illiteracy of our people in Sierra Leone is so very high that it is very difficult to reach out to people to understand what it is and how it can be spread and how it can be prevented. So considering the level of ignorance and denial, the level of the kind of cultural practice of handshake and hugs in Sierra Leone, coupled with poor infrastructure and poor health facilities and, you know, difficult access to health facilities, it is very difficult for me to say that we cannot be worried in such a condition.
Tell me, Mr. Tarawali, how much more help and what do you actually need in Sierra Leone from the international community to stem this crisis?
For now, as a matter of urgency, what we will need is support in the form of medical experts to come to Sierra Leone to help at district level and to also help Sierra Leone to have test centers and treatment centers in every district. Because to have just two treatment centers in just two districts out of 14 districts, you know, it's a headache. It's a difficult thing. It's a challenge. If we have treatment centers in all of the districts, then it will be easier to treat emergency cases and it will reduce the possibility of people dying out of Ebola if they are easily and early cases.
If there are any doctors or specialists listening to this interview with you, Mr. Tarawali, and they want to help, who can they contact?
The central coordinating body for all of our Ebola response in Sierra Leone is the Ministry of Health and Sanitation.
Abubakar Tarawali with the Sierra Leone Red Cross, thank you very much.
Welcome.
In East Africa, a different sort of fear of persecution. You remember that law passed in Uganda last December, the Anti-Homosexuality Act? It criminalizes LGBT people and even anyone promoting gay rights. The penalty? A life sentence in jail. Now a group is challenging the law in constitutional court in the capital, Kampala. Lester Fader has been covering the news out of Uganda for BuzzFeed.
Back when the law was finally passed, and folks may remember that this has been debated for several years, and it had sort of quieted down. And then kind of out of nowhere, on the last day of the parliamentary session in December, the speaker brought it up for a vote. And at the time, the president's representative in parliament called for a quorum call. The speaker ignored the quorum call and passed the legislation anyway. So when the arguments began today, the first question the court took up was whether the law was lawfully passed in the first place because there was no quorum.
And as for the Anti-Homosexuality Act itself, You said it's been debated, had been debated for several years prior to its getting passed in December. Who actually wanted that law in the first place?
It came out of, in part, a meeting of some American evangelical anti-gay activists who were invited to Uganda by some religious leaders and anti-gay activists in the country. And that kind of catalyzed what was not a major issue in Uganda into something that became a very prominent political issue.
The Ugandan Constitutional Court, I gather, has ruled in favor of LGBT rights in the past. So what needs to happen now for this law to be repealed?
That's correct. There have been a couple important cases. The first one was brought back in 2006. In this case, a person named Victor Mukasa, who was a trans activist who at the time was the head of this group, Sexual Minorities Uganda, which is known as SMUG, his house was raided. And so he sued the Attorney General of Uganda essentially for an unlawful search of his house. And after a few years in the courts, he actually won a judgment in his favor in 2008. And then not long after that, David Kato, who was another activist involved with SMUG, brought a lawsuit against a tabloid called Rolling Stone, which had been publishing a series of articles outing Ugandan gay people.
And obviously not the American Rolling Stone.
Not the American Rolling Stone, that's right. And he also won that suit, and the publication was ordered to stop publishing those stories. Unfortunately, Kato was killed about a few weeks after that ruling came down.
I remember that.
It does show that the Ugandan courts have been willing in the past to exercise some independence, even on a question as sensitive as this.
Is your sense that this law, this anti-homosexuality law, could be repealed?
The court did something very surprising today. They were originally scheduled to take up this matter in September, and then abruptly on Friday announced that they were going to hear the case this week. They got into court, and a lawyer for the government said that she wasn't ready and wanted some more time, and they took a short recess and came back and said, no, we're going to start right now. So certainly the court seems inclined to take action faster than most people assumed it would. I've talked to a couple people in Uganda, and while nothing is certain, the opponents of the law seem to be encouraged by what happened today.
Are you getting a sense from other places in Africa where gay rights are also kind of in jeopardy, just symbolically, what revisiting this law in Uganda means for them?
It's an interesting question. I think the news is still too soon, but this is not the only lawsuit in Africa regarding LGBT rights right now. There was a ruling, I believe, last week from Kenya that a transgender activist group had brought suit because they'd been denied the opportunity to register their organization because the names of the petitioners, who were using female names, I believe, did not match their male birth names. And in that case, the Kenyan court said that no, in fact, that they did have the right to register. And that's a very encouraging sign for LGBT activists that the courts might still be a good avenue for protecting LGBT rights, even as the political system seems to be growing increasingly hostile.
Lester Fader, foreign correspondent with BuzzFeed. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're dialed into the world on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. You've been pretending you're living on Mars. For 4 months, you've lived in a volcanic crater with nothing but reconstituted mush to eat. What's your first meal when you finished with the experiment?
I made sure to order a big rack of ribs so that I had something to bite into.
Life on Mars, sort of. That's just ahead on the world.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. What do you do when everyone's against you? Might seem that way to Russia's Vladimir Putin. Yesterday, the U.S. and the European Union announced new sanctions against Moscow, punishment for the Kremlin's continued support of pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine. Today, we learned that the EU sanctions, for the first time, specifically target three members of Putin's inner circle. Russian officials say the sanctions are destructive and short-sighted, but will they persuade Putin to back off of Ukraine? Here's Charles Maines in Moscow. This would seem a bad week for the Kremlin. On top of accusations of Moscow's culpability in the downing of Malaysia Air Flight 17, Western governments finally announced sectoral sanctions against the Russian economy. Now the U.S. and, more importantly, the European Union are imposing a range of penalties and embargoes on Russia's energy, banking, and defense sectors. High-ranking Kremlin officials were also added to travel ban lists in Europe, and adding insult to injury, an arbitration court in The Hague ruled this week that Russia owes shareholders of the Yukos Oil Company $50 billion for illegally renationalizing the oil and gas company a decade ago. But if all of this was designed to change the Kremlin's calculus in Ukraine, Russian political analyst Fyodor Krasheninnikov says don't bet on it. Russia's political elite operate by different rules. He says America and Europe think they're being tough, but to Russia's elite it comes across as cowardice. You can't do anything except pass these sanctions against us. You're afraid to fight, you're afraid to send troops into Ukraine, and you can't do anything to us. And so if we send troops into Ukraine, what are you going to do then? Publicly, Russian officials are taking a softer line. They insist Western partners, and they always refer to them as partners, ignore the Kremlin's efforts to sponsor peace talks in eastern Ukraine. In a press conference on Monday, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov insisted that sanctions would not reduce the Kremlin to hysterics. In fact, Lavrov, President Putin, and others in the Kremlin have said that sanctions provide Russia with an opportunity, a chance to look inward and develop underperforming portions of the Russian economy.
I think there is a large self-delusional component. I mean, when you don't like something, you pretend that there is actually a positive sign to this.
Konstantin Sanin is an economist with the Higher School of Economics in Moscow.
Of course, they're damaging to the Russian economy. It is bad in terms of modernization, bad in terms of overall development, so there will be damage. Another thing is that this damage will not be immediate, so an ordinary Russian citizen would not see any kind of effect in his or her daily life.
At Vedenkha Park in Moscow, Russians can stroll past grand exhibits of past Soviet economic achievement. Or they would if it weren't so hot out. Most people are sitting by the park's water fountain just trying to beat the heat. When asked about the new round of sanctions, most react with equal doses of resolve and resentment. It's unfair. No one loves Russia except for Russians themselves, says Yulia, a government worker. They're just uninformed in the U.S. and in Europe, says Olga. Russia has nothing to do with Ukraine. She adds she follows events about Ukraine on Russian television. These sanctions will go nowhere, says Vika, a student in a New York Yankees baseball cap. In place of Europe, we'll have other partners. Recent independent polls suggest some 60% of Russians remain unconcerned about the impact of the sanctions, though observers say that may change. And in fact, the only ones here who seemed even remotely worried were these guys, Sevold and Nikolai, two former soldiers turned traders of Siberian huskies. But they'll never bend, says Nikolai. Just like they didn't for Hitler and for Napoleon. Russians are hard-headed that way. And with that, Sevold and Nikolai noted the heat and headed out into the water. Sanctions or summer, sometimes the only thing to do is hold your breath and take the plunge. For The World, this is Charles Maines in Moscow.
If you've seen the pictures online, and if you haven't seen them, you really should. They're pretty eerie. If you've seen those pictures, you, like millions of others, are almost certainly wondering, what in the world are those huge new holes in Siberia? The discovery of the two bizarre craters in far northern Russia near the Arctic Ocean has kicked off a whirl of X-Files-like speculation about extraterrestrial origins. But so far, very few scientists have actually visited the sites. Geologist Vladimir Romanovsky at the University of Alaska Fairbanks is not among those who have seen the holes firsthand, but he's been in touch with Russian colleagues who have. First of all, for those of our listeners who have not yet seen these images, what are we talking about? What do these holes in the Siberian tundra actually look like?
So from the pictures, it's about maybe 20, 30 meters in across and maybe up to 10 meters deep. And also very icy walls and some water on the bottom. But the most interesting part is the material surrounding these holes, which it looks like it was ejected from the hole. And that's it's really make this kind of feature a mystery.
Yeah, and what does that suggest to you, that there's this kind of like mound around the ring of the hole?
Well, normally, I would say it would look like big sinkhole, but all these sinkholes actually collapsed inside. But this one, it seems like it's erupted.
So just to convert your measurements, we're talking a hole about 35 yards wide and 15 yards deep. Now, these craters in Siberia are, like a lot of Siberia, a pretty remote place. Is it possible that these holes have actually been there for a while?
Well, it seems like it's pretty new because how this ejected material is look like. Also, usually these holes will be probably filled with water eventually and maybe refreeze even. So it's definitely new features. I would say not older than a year or so.
So, I mean, I still want to know how this happened. What's your best guess from what you know from talking with your Russian colleagues and your own work studying permafrost and tundra?
Well, we can only speculate at this point, but I kind of speculate that because of warmer climate, the ice melted inside of the ground, developing this big cavity. And then in this cavity, for some reason, pressure increased dramatically, and eventually the pressure was more than what ground above can hold, and that was exploded, erupted.
You mentioned also, Dr. Romanofsky, just a warming climate. Are we talking climate change possibly leading to these giant holes?
That's true, especially in the high latitudes and in Arctic. This increase in temperature is very significant.
So two of these new giant holes have been discovered. Do you think as people start looking, we'll start finding more?
That's definitely, because now we know what to look for, even in Alaska. And just last week, I was in the Seward Peninsula area, and I saw very, very similar round lake. Now it's already kind of vegetated a little bit, and so it's definitely old. But it looks very, very similar. You can imagine, instead of this round lake, this hole there. So now we will be looking very carefully what we're seeing there.
And we said, obviously, the Arctic and Siberia, it's pretty sparsely populated, but there are some communities and settlements there. Is there any risk to people from this weird new phenomenon?
Well, yes, and infrastructure as well. Actually, remember this happening in the Yamal Peninsula, which right now in a very rapidly developing region in terms of gas and maybe possibly oil extraction. So that's very important to keep in mind. And now people should pay attention to this kind of phenomena.
Vladimir Romanofsky, a permafrost geologist at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
Giant holes opening up in the Siberian permafrost. That's when the headlines read, ripped from the X-Files. Speaking of which, remember Agent Mulder in the X-Files, a.k.a. David Duchovny, the actor? Turns out he's unwittingly waded into the frosty world of U.S.-Russian relations. And it's all because he plays off his Russian-sounding name in a new ad for a Russian beer.
This is the country where I was born and raised. But there is another country where I got my family name from. And sometimes I wonder...
Duchovny goes on to imagine what his life would be like if he'd grown up in Russia. He's a ballet dancer. He's a cosmonaut. He's a hockey player. He quotes patriotic Russian verse. He grows a mustache, plays bass, and sings in a Russian band. Pretty harmless, right? Well, it was when the ad was first released, before the downing of an airliner over eastern Ukraine. Russians are paying more attention to it now, and it has split public opinion. Some praise Duchovny for expressing what America really thinks about Russia. Others condemn him for, as they see it, becoming a political pawn in the service of Vladimir Putin. Today, Duchovny responded to the controversy via TMZ. The actor reportedly told the popular website that the commercial is not a political statement. You can judge for yourself. We've got the ad posted on our website, PRI.org. The truth is out there. Now, here's something you haven't heard in a while at the World, a geoquiz. We're looking for the name of the geopolitical border that once stretched from the Barents Sea to the Black Sea. During the Cold War, this border separated communist East from the capitalist European West. Now that the Cold War is over, we think, the demarcation has taken on a less foreboding role. It's now a bicycle path. Michael Kramer is a German member of the European Parliament. He's been promoting the idea of a bike trail along this historic boundary. Michael, tell us, first of all, what is the name of this trail?
The answer to the geo quiz is the Iron Curtain Trail. And it runs from the Barents Sea to the Black Sea. It touches 20 countries, and 15 of them are today member states of the European Union. And if I would have told you that 25 years ago, you would have said, that is a crazy guy.
Yeah.
But that is reality.
So the Iron Curtain Trail from the Barents Sea to the Black Sea. The Black Sea is near Turkey. The Barents Sea, though, that's way up north, right?
Yeah, that is the border between Norway and Russia on the Barents Sea. And then it runs on the Norwegian-Russian and the Finnish-Russian border. And then the Baltic coastlines of Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Kaliningrad, Poland, and the former GDR coastline.
Right, so you can take a whole bike ride through history. You're biking it today. What section are you on?
Yeah, from Gdansk to Gdynia. And tomorrow we go by boat to the Peninsula Hill and then further to the west.
So as you're going down the Iron Curtain Trail, do you get a sense of history? I mean, do you feel like you are at times thrown back into the Cold War?
Of course, because I come from Berlin. And when the wall came down in Berlin, we made an initiative for the Berlin Wall Trail. That is a bicycle route where the wall used to be. Today, it is signposted, it is built in a bicycle-friendly manner, and it is a touristic highlight because the people are coming to Berlin. They are coming because of the history.
Tell me about the past few days of biking the trail and things you've seen. What is the most kind of historically evocative moment you've had on your bike ride?
First of all, you can't imagine that 25 years ago, it wasn't possible, for example, to go on the coast. That was in the border stretches, that was a military area. It was forbidden for normal people to go there. And in the night, you are not allowed to be on the beach because they thought you can go by boat to leave the country because it was all forbidden. And today you are so free and you can see the Death Strip. There was no tree, nothing. And today the nature has recovered this area, and that is a wonderful feeling. Mm. We have overcome, and people, citizens, have overcome the division of Europe without a war. Nobody could imagine this 25 years ago.
I know you're a history buff, Michael. What do you hope cyclists will take away from their experience cycling the Iron Curtain Trail?
Yeah. If you cycle, you are fast enough to see a lot and slow enough to look at it. And here you can stop. There is a monument. You can stop. There is a watchtower. And cross often the border to have a feeling. 25 years ago, it wasn't possible. And today, it is not necessary to show your passport.
I know there's one section of the trail that requires a Russian visa. I don't know if you have it, but are you going to bike all the way to the Black Sea?
Yeah, that is possible. You need a visa in Russia and, of course, in Kaliningrad. Mm. There you need it. My son, for example, has done with two friends the stretch from the Norwegian-Russian border and the Barents Sea to St. Petersburg with a visa. That was not a problem.
So how many more days do you have until you complete the 10,000 kilometers to the Black Sea?
I have done until now 5,000 kilometers. In the next 5 years, I will do the rest. But in this year, there was an e-bike. E-bikers,
yeah.
They made it from the Barents Sea to the Black Sea in 30 days.
Wow.
With e-bikes, and of course very fast, and they just arrived on the Black Sea.
Well, you're taking the right approach, I think. Slow and steady wins the race, as they say.
Of course.
Michael Kramer, now in Gdansk, Poland. He's been cycling on the Iron Curtain Bicycle Trail, which is the answer to our geoquiz today. Happy trails to you, Michael. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
And a round of applause, please, for Marcia in Damascus, Oregon, Patrick in Graysonville, Maryland, and Alexandra in Orlando, Florida. They came up with the correct answer to our quiz. Thank you for playing. If your hands are free and you want to play along, just text GeoQuiz, one word, to 69866. Again, that's GeoQuiz, one word, to 69866. So what music do you play for a cyclist touring the boundary of the old Iron Curtain? A Russian DJ obsessed with Jamaican reggae and dub. Here's DJ Vadim. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. If you've ever wondered what it would be like to live on Mars, ask Ross Lockwood. The Canadian physicist spent the past 4 months living in a NASA-built Mars simulator in Hawaii. Now, before you think, oh yeah, Hawaii, tough job, consider this. Lockwood and five other researchers lived inside a dome located in a volcanic crater, and they actually tried to mimic conditions on the red planet. That meant having to wear a spacesuit when they left the dome. Lockwood says the sightseeing was not much fun.
We were limited to about 1 or 2 miles on foot, just because the lava flows themselves are so difficult to traverse, and because the spacesuits that we had were actual analog simulators, which made them very heavy and very difficult to move around in.
What was the biggest challenge for you guys? I mean, you're six researchers, adult researchers, living in how many square feet for 120 days?
The square footage was about 1,600 square feet for the six crew. I think the main challenges were related to the primary study, the things that the researchers wanted to know about psychology and crew psychology in isolation and how that changes over the function of a long-duration surface mission. We also had challenges like power outages, water shortages, and communications outages that really stressed the crew out.
With a power outage on Mars, you wouldn't last very long. So obviously there's some things that you can't simulate.
Well, the power outage was actually very analogous to the Apollo 13 oxygen stir tank issue, where we received instructions on how to reset a system, and that ended up kicking our system offline completely. During the power outage, we actually stayed completely within simulation, so we didn't have to break any rules to fix that problem. But for about 2 hours, we were scrambling to find batteries that we could hook up to reset one of the controllers that had failed.
Did you breathe any fresh air during those 120 days?
There was an incident on one of my spacesuits during one of our spacewalks where I tripped over a rock and the bubble dome that was protecting my face from the air and the sun fell off, but it was about 30 milliseconds worth of fresh air for me. So it was really nothing to be proud about. The thing that I was missing the most from the real world was the feel of wind on my face. So during that brief window where the helmet had fallen off, I definitely got to feel the wind on my face, and it was quite a shock, actually.
And what about food? What do you eat for 120 days?
We had our shelves stocked with dehydrated fruits, meats, and vegetables, along with shelf-stable foods, pastas, sauces like this. But the one thing that I really missed was the consistency of being able to bite into something that had some texture. When we left the habitat, we all ordered our favorite foods from Earth. So I made sure to order a big rack of ribs so that I had something to bite into.
Ross, you volunteered for this Mars simulator. Would you actually go to Mars if the opportunity presented itself?
So the one criteria that I have for actually going on a mission to Mars would be that it has to have a return trip. And I know there are several proposals right now to do Mars colonies that have no planned return trip. I just think that that would be out of my wheelhouse.
Ross Lockwood, who just got out last Friday of the Mars simulator located in Hawaii. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much, Marco. I appreciate it.
And you can see photos, great photos, of Ross's simulated life on Mars there at PRI.org. I'd take the ribs, too, but if I spent 4 months in a Mars simulator, I'd also want to listen to some kickin' music when I was finished, because you don't want to bother your pod mates. Luckily, I've got Just a Thing, a band from the Caribbean island of Curaçao. Alex Gallivan brings us a story of KIT.
KIT is an acronym, K-I-T,
which is short for Cuenta y Tambú, meaning drums and stories.
That's in Papiamento, the most commonly spoken language on Curaçao. And Cuenta y Tambú is actually the other way around. It means stories and drums.
Tambú is the name of the drums but it's also the name for the music style, the dance, and the, it's like a whole culture on itself.
Roel Calista leads Kit and makes sure the band draws on Curaçao's history, like featuring the tambu drum itself.
It's made out of, it's an old rum barrel, and we use goat skin to, you know, to have it tight.
Well, that's how the old ones were made anyway. Modern tambu drums have to stand up to the rigors of touring clubs around the world. Still, it remains loud and low, just right for bone-shaking dance parties. Calista says tambu music traces its roots back to the slaves who were brought to Curaçao and to the songs they sang.
The instruments were taken away, so all they had left was the hand clapping, the foot stamping, and the singing. And they used to sing the tambu songs really low because the rest of the world wasn't supposed to hear it.
Calista knows his history. He used to teach school workshops on the subject.
You wouldn't have much time, so you would just show the instrument and say, like, really quick what it's normally used for and what we use it for in our music.
Kit, his band, looks as much to the future as the past. 4 years ago, Calista started to add electronics to the sound and rhythms from club culture.
What would it sound like if you added a four-to-the-floor kick drum, you know?
Electronics are one thing, but Calista needed a great singer too.
I saw this video from a friend of mine, and there was this crazy MC jumping and running from one side of the stage to the other one. Hyping up the crowd like crazy. And what made it more interesting is the fact that this particular MC was from Aruba, like the sister island of Curaçao, meaning she would understand the traditions, she would speak the same language.
Her name was Diamanta von Leijdek. Calista called her up. It was a fast process.
This is the stuff. Boom, boom, boom. See you Saturday. Okay.
I mean, it was a match, but also on a personal level.
Behind the scenes,
you know, you drive together to a show and you chill a bit, you talk about things and you see where it all relates to each other. And so, yeah, after we came back from tour, it was like, okay, yeah.
They call me one of the boys.
The Alchemy's plain to hear on Kit's latest album, Tambutronic.
It's, I would say, nasty.
Yeah, it's nasty. Yeah.
For the world, I'm Alex Galifant.
Kit with music from Curaçao. Drums and stories. We'll have more stories and probably more drums again tomorrow. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. RitaAllen.org, by the Ford Foundation, by PRI's New Voices Fund, whose donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, MacFound.org. The PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation. And by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security at carnegie.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.